The following is an interview with Timothy Baldwin, who is the son of Chuck Baldwin. He had recently written a book on Romans 13, and much of the information is good and correct, except for the simple fact that the word in Romans 13 that they translate power actually means liberty or right to choose, which we show you in the book Higher Liberty, free on the net at hisholychurch.org. But we thought you would find the interview interesting, so here we go.
Welcome to Keys to the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're going to talk about the kingdom of God. We have a special guest this week. He is a practicing attorney in Montana. I guess he was also an attorney in Florida. He received a Juris Doctor degree in Cumberland School of Law at Sanford University in Birmingham, Alabama. He also does a number of other things that makes him stand out amongst most of the attorneys I've known over my life. He's interested in state sovereignty, and he has written or co-authored a book with his fairly well-known father, Chuck Baldwin, who ran for presidency in the Constitutional Party, if I'm correct, and also is a very outspoken minister, and both of them are authors on newswithviews.com, which is where I guess we've crossed paths somehow or other. And so we're going to have Timothy on the show, and we'll see where the conversation leads us. Welcome, Timothy Baldwin.
Thank you very much, Greg. It's good to be on the show this morning.
Okay, well, your book, I just finished reading it at the last minute last night, which is usually when I get everything done at the last minute, and it has lots of footnotes. I think it has almost as many as my first book, Covenants of the Gods. And when I read a book, I don't just read the footnotes. I actually go to the original authors and read the quote in context to see if this is really what that author was talking about. And so it took me quite a bit longer to read your book because I had to go read everybody from Rousseau to Pufendorf, which is a lot of people that most people never read, although some of those same quotes that were in your book I've had in some of our books because I've been reading these guys for a long time. It can be very educational if people were to read that book in that way, because I believe that education is a responsibility of everybody, and we should not just listen to any one person as if they've got the whole truth. God's the only one that's got the whole truth, and so I think that in listening to one another and challenging one another, we end up iron sharpens iron, and occasionally a little sparks may fly in that. But the name of the book is Romans 13. Actually, I don't have it sitting right in front of me, but there's a subtitle of The True Meaning of Submission. And Romans 13 is one of those common quotes from the Bible that we often hear. I'm not very good at remembering verse and chapter. I can remember what it says. I can talk about the Greek. I can talk about the Hebrew. But for some reason, my brain, I can remember page numbers of books I read 20 years ago, but I cannot, I have a difficult time remembering, you know, the scriptural classifications that have come down and the numbering of each individual verse. But Romans 13, simply by the number of times I've heard people bring it up, I remember that one really well. So, and we've written our own book. I don't know if you had a chance to read that or glance over it on Romans 13.
Yeah,
but
it is.
I think that it's a very important verse, because it is kind of a verse that's been used to kind of neuter the church and neuter Christianity. Christianity is a very powerful way in which people should, it should change every aspect of your life. And people seem to create a whole taboo zone using that single quote of Romans 13, or maybe Titus and a few other small quotes in the Bible, and disregard the whole spirit of the Bible. So Why don't you tell us and the listeners out there a little bit about why you and your father decided to co-author this book and what you hope to accomplish by writing it?
Well, we had the same experience that you described with so many Christians using this verse, or this actually not just one verse, but the entire chapter of Romans 13, and using it to hold a position that we as Christians do not have the duty, the obligation, the responsibility to get engaged with government and to ensure and make sure that government is held accountable to these fundamental standards of right and wrong. And they go on about their lives. You know, the interesting part about that is that a lot of these same people are very studious when it comes to business, or when it comes to other realms of personal life and that sort of thing. But when it comes to government, they just have a hands-off approach, and they use this verse, which I believe, and my dad, we firmly believe it's just is not a correct interpretation of Scripture. So we thought it was necessary to expound this subject further. And that's what we did with this book, Romans 13, The True Meaning of Submission. We hope that when people read the book, they will, first of all, get a better understanding of how to think for themselves, how to analyze scriptures, interpret scriptures using sound rules of interpretation, to come up with these conclusions on their own. And we have, unfortunately, we have pastors today who are not guiding their congregations truthfully in this regard, and I think a lot of that has to do with the 501c corporate status that the church operates under. And so the congregations are just simply ignorant on the subject, or either not interested. So we have to get back to this notion that it's our personal responsibility to know what God's laws are relevant to our conduct in all areas of life.
Absolutely. That's why I started talking immediately about the fact that education is a personal responsibility. We have to educate ourselves. We have to go the 9 yards or more to actually, like the Bereans, to crack open the books and understand what these books that have been passed down from the ages really mean. I find that the Old Testament and the New Testament are very much in agreement with one another. It's just all the people who read it are in disagreement. And a lot of that is preconceived notions, personal agendas, and what have you. But one of the most helpful things in understanding the context of the Bible is looking at the definition of words. From the beginning, the deceiver used words to help deceive Adam and Eve, and that hasn't changed. We've been deceived a great deal by not understanding words, and we use words like power and society and social contract and state of nature, state of society. I'm reading off some of the things that I put down in my notes, ordained. What are all these words meaning? And one of the first things that you mentioned in the early part of your books was the doctrine of passive submission. And then you used to a de facto government. Can you tell us a little bit about what you think this doctrine of passive submission is? And is it good? Is it bad? And how that began to work on your thinking?
Well, the doctrine of passive submission is similar to what we described earlier, where Christians think and believe that God would have them do nothing concerning government action or government formation or government anything relating to its form or its substance. It's a hands-off approach. It's a I'm indifferent to what they're doing. They're going to do what they're going to do. It's ordained of God. I can't do anything about it. I have to sit back and just let it happen. That's a passive. It's passive doctrine relative to de facto government. The significance of using that de facto government is that there really is no determination made by the person, by the Christian or otherwise, whether the government is a lawful government or if it's just some people holding power that have the force of the sword or the force of taxation upon you. There is a difference between de facto government and de jure government. De facto is just, you know, government in fact or government by power, and then de jure government is government by law or government by authority, meaning it's God ordained. So the doctrine of passive submission doesn't care if it's de facto or de jure. It just simply submits to whoever has the most power. And that is a slavist doctrine. It's not scriptural. And that's one of the essences of the book that we wrote.
Yeah, I think that if that were true, simply the guy who had the most power should be ruler, then certainly David should not have challenged the people like Goliath, who had more power seemingly, but David did challenge Goliath. There's an old maxim of law: things captured by pirates and robbers do not change the ownership. So if you have a government that's simply there by the power of the sword, it's not really government as much as it is a pirate or a Goliath who wants to usurp authority over you simply by his own power and might. The reality is that one of the things that we talk about a great deal here is that God really doesn't create these governments. God created us. And we went out and created governments. And God has some guidelines as to how we should do that. We should be the binding agent of our governments. Should it be covetousness? Should it be a desire to rule over our neighbor and our brother? I mean, Cain created a government. But he had to go out of the presence of God in order to create that government.
Yeah.
And we have a choice. Do we want to live in Cain's government or do we want to live in God's government? And I think that if we pay attention to that, it will change the course of a great many of our actions. And I did read this just this morning. I saw it. I wanted to read it before we went on the air, your father's latest article on the 501c3 church. We've discussed that so many times before. It's the last chapter of the book, Covenants of the Gods, which we have on our website, is the body of Christ versus the body of the state. In a very short 5,000-word essay, we address the fact that this idea of incorporating the church under the authority of the state is really not a Christ-like idea. Christ would not appeal to Rome for protection. He could have, but he didn't, because to appeal to Rome for protection would subject the church, because subjection draws protection, and protection draws subjection, another maxim of law. So the church should not be incorporating. One of the quotes that we point out is, in many states you'll find this, anyone who incorporates under the authority of this statute of the state or this law of the state, all other previous incorporation is null and void. And we consider the church should be the corporation of Christ under his authority, the corpus of Christ, the body of Christ. And when you incorporate under the state, you really become a part of the body of the state.
Yeah.
And you shouldn't be looking to it for protection. Christ should be sufficient. But evidently, that concept hasn't been real popular with most churches. Do you guys get a lot of flack, or do they just avoid you, or do they shun you when you talk about these things?
Well, it depends on who you're talking about. I mean, certainly there are certainly some people disagree with the position that if you're 501c3, then you're just a state corporation, you're not doing God's work, etc. They hold the position that since they're doing good, or since they are, preaching from the Bible, or they're, they have, missionaries they support from the church, etc., that they are purely purely God's institution and not the state's corporation. But I think that they're overlooking the significance of what it means to be a state corporation. When you become a state corporation, which is what a 501c3 corporation is, or any other corporate status under state law is, you are invoking not only the protection of the state, you're actually invoking the definition of the state. See, when you apply for corporate status, you have to define your corporation. What's its purpose? Ministering the gospel. So when you do that, the state actually defines and makes the definition of what that means. And when it comes to, let's just say, the tax exemption question, and the state determines, or the federal government determines, well, you've stepped outside of your limited power that we've given you as a corporation, and therefore we're going to take away your tax exemption status. This is the reason a lot of preachers and a lot of deacons, board members, what have you, are all too unwilling to step out and call certain actions in government to be wrong, because they're afraid that they will lose that financial benefit they receive from a corporate structure. And so they think about the bills they have to pay, and the staff they have to pay, and all the different programs that they put on in the church. Think about the debt that they probably have with the buildings they built and all that sort of thing. And so they're simply not willing to risk losing the property and the money for stepping outside of their corporate protection. And that right there is a unjust and it's unrighteous affiliation and connection to the state.
Right. You're giving it every time you apply to the state for anything. There usually is a portion of your liberty that disappears.
Yeah.
Because they very seldom offer you any benefit without at least some strings attached. We've equated the idea of this 501. We've had this phrase, and I try to discuss this as often as I can. This 501c3 is, most people don't understand what that is. It's part of the titles. It's how you find the code that governs charitable organizations within the statutory codes of the United States. And it's, section 501, section C, and there are several sections there that they have charitable organizations under, but churches don't have to apply for 501c3 status. That's an exception that's in the IRS regulations. It's actually under 508c1, I think, of the codes. That churches are mandatorily, the only place you'll find the word mandatorily, which, you won't even find it in some dictionaries, but excluded from having to file, churches are automatically even considered exempt by the IRS, even if they don't file. But it's that filing of the 1023 that gets these churches in trouble. Of course, many of them have already incorporated at that point when they do that.
Problem too, we see, Greg, is that and it's really a kind of a curious question to me as to why the seminaries in the United States have not taught on the subject and the significance of filing under 501c3 tax exemption status. Why are they not, first of all, giving them the knowledge that you just described, that you don't have to? And secondly, not giving them the potential consequences of, if you do this, this is what could happen. Because I think if they were serious about that, which they should be, because I think you probably know specific stories, and I know specific stories, where the government has shut down churches, seized their property, because they claim that they violated tax code or what have you, because of their corporate status. So why aren't the seminaries teaching these students this? Well, I don't know if it's because the leaders of those seminaries are getting too much money and they themselves would risk government oversight or government scrutiny, being an educational institution that's a 501c3, and they don't want to shake that tree. So, but it's a problem because the churches today simply are not speaking out on the matters that are clearly within the scriptures either evil or clearly within our Constitution are unconstitutional. And it's just really amazing to me that so many Christians today just hold this position that God in the New Testament only requires us to preach the gospel, and that's our only commission, and we have no responsibility to these other important matters of life. That's just silliness. It's absurd. It's not reality. So hopefully people can do something like maybe read the book and learn more about it.
Well, one of the things that we point out is that the Bible really talks about government almost more than it talks about anything else.
Absolutely. I think you're right on that.
Cain was starting a government, and he, like I said, he had to go out of the presence of God to do it, and clearly was going a different way than Abel and Seth. Nimrod, it's a government. Abraham, what'd he do? He left Ur, a government. He left Haran, a government. How did he govern himself out there and with all these other people? And when some group of kings got together and could go and conquer one city state after another, including Sodom and Gomorrah, who was it who saved the day? Who was it who freed all those people? It was Abraham. Well, what government did he belong to? What was he doing out there? We use these terms like government as if you say government, you mean this thing way over here. But Christ was preaching a government, a kingdom of God. It wasn't like the governments of the Gentiles. It didn't operate with forced taxation. It operated with free will offerings. Well, yeah. If you go back to Israel under Moses, almost every time they have an offering, it's a free will offering. Free will offering, local militias is what supplied the army. How'd they take care of their widows and orphans? How did they take care of their health, education, and welfare? How did they take care of social services? They went to the Levites, who were the ministers of their church in the wilderness.
Yeah.
Early Christians took care of all the social welfare of early Christians through faith, hope, and charity. Early America, the churches took care of all the social welfare of early Americans through faith, hope, and charity. This movement of modern Christianity to say that, I actually was on a first century church forum years ago, and they said, well, we have these social welfare programs today. They didn't have them in Rome. Well, that's absolutely historically false. They had health care. They had food that was given away all to the government. But those were provided by men who call themselves benefactors but exercise authority, something early Rome didn't do, but the imperial Rome did. And it changed the nature of Rome. And it's changing the nature of America. It's not just the church looking for protection to the government in every aspect of its existence. It's the actual people also rushing to the government and forgetting, phrases that we hear in the early days of America. As long as you look to government to solve your problems, you will always suffer tyranny. The actual individuals are going not to church for their social welfare, not to their neighbors who should be loving one another, but they go to a bureaucratic government. And I think that it's killing the community, and it's killing the community of the church.
Everything that you just described there is true, especially, we talk about historical facts, you're right on, and that's related to our conditions today. You're right. We have such a weak community. We have such weak states. We have a weak country because the people are so reliant upon whatever government agency has been created to supposedly solve a problem. And we just have our hands out. And that's not a Christian doctrine at all.
Right. Well, we're going to go to a break here. We'll be back with Timothy Baldwin on Keys to the Kingdom in just a moment.
name is Mark and I'm from Melbourne in Australia, and I'm a minister in the church established by Jesus Christ more than 2,000 years ago. After reading the books published at hisholychurch.org, I realised that mainstream Christianity had taken a wrong turn by forgetting what Jesus said to do, to practice pure religion while remaining unspotted from the world. What does this mean and how is this done exactly? You'll find out when you go to hisholychurch.org and discover what it truly means to be in the world but not of it, and what it means perhaps for the first time to truly love God and your neighbour as much as yourself. The kingdom of God is at hand. Join the Living Network at hisholychurch.org.
Hi, I'm Brent. I'm a contact minister for the Living Network in Northeast Missouri. You're not the only one out there with the desire to learn the truth. There are people all over the world coming together in faith, hope, and charity. Join us at one of the upcoming gatherings to meet new people, fellowship, work, and play. Whether it's the Fall Burning Bush Festival in Oregon or the Spring Gathering in Northeast Missouri, you'll get all the details when you join the Living Network. Go to hisholychurch.org and click on the network link. Find out what you've been missing. You'll be glad you did.
Welcome back to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and we're talking about the kingdom of God. We're specifically talking about Romans 13 and some of the misconceptions that have come down as people have crept into our congregations and taught us what might be considered damnable heresies, thinking that Americans or Christians throughout the world should not be questioning the deeds and actions of the governments that they create. You know, we are the creators of most governments, the people. And one way or the other, we either create them overtly through agreements or contracts or applications, or we do it through neglect because we don't do anything about it. And so we've been discussing Romans 13 with Timothy Baldwin, son of Chuck Baldwin, an attorney. I know that, Timothy, you have some other interests. Can you tell us what your website is and what that's all about?
Yeah, my website is libertydefenseleague.com, and it has essentially the efforts that I'm engaged in right now. I'm certainly very interested in I kind of feel that, Greg, you and I probably study a lot of the same material just based upon what you have been talking about today, the words you've been using and the concepts you've been expressing. It kind of almost sounds like I'm talking to myself a little bit, but, the study of philosophy relative, to scriptural understanding and truth. And I have a focus on political truths. I particularly am interested in the concepts of reforming the federal union, the 50-state union as we know it today, which I believe is simply unworkable given the diverse interests throughout the union. As political philosophers have noted throughout history, the bigger a country is, the more concentrated and centralized the power will be, thus creating essentially a monarchy or even a dictatorship eventually. For us to have a republic, the formula for that typically has been recognized as being a smaller community with the ability of the people to control their representatives in that smaller territory. So, if you start looking into the details of what it means to have a federal union, I don't think that our founding fathers really expected the union, which originally started with 13 states, to grow to what it did so quickly. In fact, if you read some of Thomas Jefferson's writings on that subject, he didn't think that the West would be civilized or inhabited for another 1,000 years. And that's very interesting to think about, because no sooner did the ink dry on his paper than the Western states were almost all developed in formed into states and admitted into the Union just a few decades after he said that. So again, they did not anticipate an industrial society. They did not anticipate a technological society. They did not recognize that people would be able to travel from one end of the country to the other in a matter of several minutes. And all of the factors that go into that, they didn't consider that when ratifying the Constitution. As a matter of fact, Greg, you're probably familiar with these things I'm about to say. Those who were opposed to the U.S. Constitution were largely opposed to it because they felt the U.S. Constitution would not be able to govern the number of states that existed even at that time. They thought that there would be too strong of a opposition against each other under that one centralized authority. So as we've seen history progress in the United States, we have seen a centralization of power. We have seen the federal government overtake the power of the states, thereby creating more of a monarchy-type government than a republic government, which was what was created in the first place. So that's kind of a long way of saying I'm pretty interested in discussing how reformation can be obtained in this country. And, of course, as we're discussing today, Grant, the Romans 13 book that I just authored with my dad, which is a part theological discussion with a part political discussion, I think. And I've written another book, a political science book called Freedom for a Change. So that's pretty much summarizes my interest there, Greg. And I think the Lord is leading me down the path that will continue in that realm. And so we're kind of waiting to see where that takes me.
Well, one I'm a big one for quotes, as evidently you guys are, because like I said, there are about 700 footnotes in that book. But My daughter used to tease me years ago when I was writing, I see the footnotes, Dad, when are you going to write something? Because it seemed like half of everything I was writing was quoting somebody else, but I guess it was because why should anybody believe me?
Yep,
but
yep.
The reality is, as far as this changing, there's a statement that's come down before governments will change, men must change. And so, you know, I've been on this road for a long time. My father was an attorney, and I asked him once, you know, we knew lots of people in politics. I mean, he actually knew the Bushes back when Georgie was a little kid. And although we weren't very fond of them because we knew too much about them, I guess. But I asked him why he didn't go into politics. He said he was dishonest enough to be a lawyer, but not dishonest enough to be a politician. And that, you know, I was only about 9 when he told me that. But my father was about the most honest man that I knew. He quit the law 3 times in Texas because he was disgusted with the good old boy corruption that was going on behind the scenes.
Yeah.
And never would even enter into an agreement to be in a law firm again. But he, you know, and when I first began to write, I brought my materials to him and said, what do you think? You know, and basically he talked about... told a story about how he spoke in front of the American Bar Association on the natural law when he first became an attorney, because he was pretty well accepted. He was high scorer, Creighton University, and all this stuff. And he was told by the head of the Texas Bar Association to, it was a wonderful speech, but never talk about the natural law to attorneys again. And of course, natural law is kind of where we start. Legal systems.
Yeah,
so it's very important that people understand that the average American doesn't have any knowledge of these things.
No, and what's very interesting for an attorney to say that is to show his ignorance. He's either showing his ignorance as to the origin of the law, or it's showing his prejudice to the concept of natural law. That is, there's law that God created by nature, and man's law has to conform to natural law. So one of those two is probably true for an attorney to say that. But, you know, if you look at the states in the Union today, most of them, probably all of them, still have either in their constitution or in their statutes, a recognition of the applicability of common law unless the statute has essentially excluded a particular common law cause of action, that sort of thing. But like here in Montana, you can raise a common law cause of action against someone, and it probably is done on a regular basis. And the thing about common law is it's actually natural law, as described and as expounded by our forefathers throughout Europe, and also in the colonies, and then once again in the states once they were formed. So. That right there is an interesting subject for an attorney to say that don't talk about natural law.
Yeah, I know. And my father specifically told me that story. It wasn't common to tell me stories when I handed him the first chapter of the book Covenants of the Gods, which is about the contractual nature of government. And of course, the Constitution allows us the right to contract. And we just earlier talked about this 501c3 incorporation of the church and filing 1023s with the IRS, that these are forms and ways in which the church contracts away its natural right to make choices and decisions on behalf of Christ, for Christ, in the service of Christ, and they give power to another agency or corporation of the world to make decisions for them because they have contracted away their rights. And I believe that the individual is often doing the same thing because they're looking to this corporate government or the agencies of the government, which are often have a corporate nature to them, to provide for them, and therefore they began to lose access to these natural rights. When my father first became an attorney, I remember as a small boy that he was often arguing precedent, how juries had decided cases before. Now often cases are being decided almost totally by judges based on statutes alone.
Yeah.
And the statutes should be in conformity to something, and what I think they're often in conformity to is this contractual nature of government. I mean, we used to have very few laws in this country. Now you have so many laws, rules, regulations, administrative rules. Dealing with this church issue 20 years ago, I couldn't figure out why a particular attorney of the county was kept making his conclusions in a particular way, and I realized eventually that he was basing all of his decisions on the Oregon administrative rules, not on the statutes. And reality is he's just getting more and more removed from the natural law, from what a church really was, because he's using administrative rules, which were supposed to be in conformance with the statutes. But the statutes are supposed to be in conformance with law. And if the statutes usurp the natural law, then the legislature becomes a pirate.
Something that attorneys aren't taught in law school. You know, we're essentially trained to read a case, to be able to recognize the facts, the issue, the rule, and then the conclusion. And we form everything based around that. And so an attorney, when he gets out of law school, unless he's just done independent research and thinking on his own, he comes off thinking, that's how I practice law. That is law. And so we very rarely see, with exception with some attorneys that I know who are exceptional attorneys like Herb Titus and some of the guys that, work at his firm, they do an excellent job of actually bringing out into their cases and into their briefs to the court. Not only do they bring out historical truths regarding the foundation of our country, but they bring out scriptural references, they bring out philosophical ideology, and they weave that into their argument, and that's what attorneys are supposed to do. That's what Patrick Henry did. If you read the story of Patrick Henry after the American Revolution, we won, and there was an issue being decided on the debts that the colonists held, not held, but they were the ones who were indebted to British creditors. And Patrick Henry went to Emmer D. Vattel, who I'm sure you know is the author of The Law of Nations, which is an exposition of natural law as it relates to nation to nation. And, you know, he used that, recognized that to be a fundamental concept of natural law, and that was how the case was essentially decided. It was on that basis. And so that's what attorneys should be doing, but we hardly ever see that anymore. And you know what, Greg, I think what that does, too, especially for the public who's listening to these things go on around them in the legal system, and they read these news articles, and, you know, the only thing they can think about is, well, we have to get a Supreme Court justice who's going to rule this way so we can change precedent. We got to get a president who's going to appoint this U.S. Supreme Court judge because he's going to change the precedent. They're missing the point. They're missing the fundamental concept here of having the people understand what natural law is, what the foundational law is, so that we can hold accountable not just courts, because it's actually very hard to hold courts accountable many times, but to hold accountable those people who execute laws, the executive branch, in the legislative branch. We're shirking our responsibility by trying to just simply focus on getting a judge appointed to office. That's missing the point, which goes back to our original discussion, Greg, which is Romans 13. We are, you know, if government is a minister of God, and I've heard people say this before, that, you know, we are not commissioned to get involved in politics. Well, they're completely ignoring the definitions and the words used to describe what higher powers are in Romans 13. God refers to them as ministers of God. That means government is a ministry of God, just like a pastor is a minister of God, and a teacher is a minister of God, and a prophet is a minister of God. You go through all the list of the ministers of God, and government is included in that. Well, if there's a ministry of God on earth, that requires Christians to be good stewards of that ministry and requires us to be responsible for those things around us, such as government.
In the quote, Romans 13, and the whole chapter, it goes on, it talks about rulers being a minister to God. And there's many ways in which a person can take that. You know, a person can actually refer to Hitler as a minister of God. And in some sense of the word, that's true. But in another sense, it's not. One of the things that we quote often, and of course we see it in early American Revolution, quoted by in Common Sense, which is Samuel 8, which talks about the people of Israel, who had no king for many, many years and functioned as a government. It was a different kind of government than they were once they got a king. Once they decided to vest more power in an individual and his officers, they changed the nature of their government. So, but God allowed them to do that. And allowed them to make that choice. I don't know that he necessarily, you know, we use this word appointed. There's 14 different Greek words that are translated or could be translated into the single English word appointed, and they all appear in the Bible and the New Testament alone, and we have to be careful because all these words have different meanings. There's different kinds of appointments, but God allowed Saul to be created appointed or set up as a king in Israel, but when the voice of the people chose to do that, he still described it as a rejection of God, that he should not rule over them. So there was government before Saul, there was government after Saul, but they were a different kind of government. It still was going to serve the purposes of God because it was going to teach these errant children a lesson. And he tells Samuel, now tell them what's going to happen when they do this. Allow them to do it. Give them the freedom to make that choice, But tell them what's going to happen. What's going to happen is that this king is going to be able to take the first fruits of your labor, the best of your fields. He's going to appoint officers over you who are going to also have this executive power. I mean, they had officers before in the government before the king, but they didn't have an executive power. All the offerings were free will offerings. He's going to take your sons. He's going to make his instruments of war. He's going to make your sons run before his chariots, which sounds like a dangerous place to be. And today, when I read that, I always flash on the image of all the military men that are have been exposed to DU and other things that are causing evidently severe health effects in young men and women who go into the military service. All these prophecies of Samuel warning us that if you decide to create an office of power like a king, that this is what's going to happen. And he's actually serving God, because God knows that eventually you'll come to a point where you're going to cry out under these burdens that are going to be placed on you. And they're being placed on you because you rejected God and did not want to have him rule over you. So to me, the solution is that people have to go back to what that early church was doing. And I'm talking not just the early church in America, which was a shining example to what we see today, but the early church in Rome and the early church in Judea and throughout the Roman Empire, that was providing the needs of the people through faith, hope, and charity. You know, I've come to the conclusion after all these years that you cannot be a socialist and a Christian. And yet I hear some people actually saying Christ was a socialist. Yeah, well, if you take the gun out of the hand of socialists, you know, well, maybe that kind of socialism Christ was. But as long as you're going to force the contributions of the people in order to provide the welfare of the people, then what should have been for your welfare will become a snare and bring you into subjection. And this is what happened with Saul. When he forced a contribution, Samuel came in and said, "Saul, why have you done this foolish thing?" It was because of that, forcing the contribution to provide for a legitimate need for his army to protect them from the Philistines, that they were moving into an area where his kingdom would not stand, because he forced this sacrifice of the people. And our modern churches, I'm not sure they are preaching the gospel. They say all we have to do is preach the gospel. I think that'd be great if you were actually doing that. But the evidence I see, the fruits of what they're preaching, is not the gospel of loving your neighbor. It's actually the gospel of coveting your neighbor's goods through the agency of government.
Yeah.
And so in order to bring this government, which is your original question at the beginning of this half hour, to bring your government, whatever government it is, whether you want to call it the United States federal government or the government of the state of Texas or whatever government, back to what government really should be, the people have to go back to what they really should be. And I think that's the whole message of the gospel. Repent. Turn around. Go another way.
Yeah.
And we point out that Judea was becoming, you know, Herod was baptizing people into the kingdom of heaven. John the Baptist was baptizing people into the kingdom of heaven. They had different visions of the kingdom. Herod thought, you join up, we force your contributions, your sacrifice to take care of the widows and needy of the and orphans of our society. But John the Baptist was saying, if you're brother has no coat and you have two, share with him. He was preaching faith, hope, and charity. And that is the dividing line between the goats and the sheep, between the true Christians and those that follow the ways of Herod and Cain and Nimrod. And so if we want to change the course of governments, we have to change the course in our own lives. And this is the bottom line of what we preach. So what are your comments on that concept?
Well, you put quite a bit out there. let me just comment on what you talked about earlier with your reference to the story of Saul. You know, when the people wanted the king, and then you know the whole scene that took place where God let them make that choice, and then he told them what was going to happen, etc. You know, people will use an example like that, and they'll use an example like King Nebuchadnezzar, who God used to enslave Israel, and we all, and, you know, we know that God used foreign countries, and he used internal government of Israel to enslave the people of Israel because of their sin, because of their idolatry, etc. But here's the distinction. Well, first of all, the conclusion the people will make is that, well, since God let that happen in the Old Testament, we see that God, God's will for people is not that they always be in freedom, but that they be in faith, and we can't do anything about it. And they use those examples. The problem is that God does not operate the way he did in the Old Testament today.
We have to stop the show right here, but we will bring Timothy's interview back on the next show and let you hear the rest of it. There are a few things here where you hear him saying that God isn't the same today as he was in the Old Testament. And the truth is, he is the same as he was in the Old Testament. We just have a distorted view of the Old Testament because they have not told us the truth about the gospel in the Old Testament. And therefore, we don't recognize the two. Moses and Jesus were in agreement. It's just the Pharisees did not understand Moses. That's why they were doing contrary to what Moses had taught, and there was a conflict between them and Jesus. This is the crux of understanding the whole Bible. It is two witnesses about the same thing. It's just not what they've been telling you. As we said, Romans 13 is really rather easy to understand once they're honest about the translation itself. There are several different words in the Greek text that are translated into the single English word power. In Romans 13, the word that is there is the strongest word in the Greek language at that time in Koine and regular classical Greek for liberty. It means liberty. It's translated as such elsewhere in the Bible. It's also translated as right. It is defined as the right to choose, and that's what it means. So when Paul says, let every man remain subject to the higher power, he is saying, let every man remain subject to the original liberty, the liberty granted to you by God, what you were endowed with, the rights you were endowed with. That is what he's talking about. Let every man remain subject to the higher liberty, because all liberty is of God. There is no liberty but of God, and anyone who opposes liberty opposes God. This is what Paul was saying, and it is absolutely clear from the Greek text, and that's what we show you in the book Higher Liberty. But we're out of time, so we'll have to explain more about this in the next show of Keys of the Kingdom. Until then, may peace be upon your house and God be with you.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.